This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, we will follow up on the Occupy Ports movement that shut down many seafaring ports across the United States overnight. Also, we will look more closely at the events in Portland, Oregon, and in Oakland, California. About the shutdowns of the ports, we'll be hearing from Angela Davis and Boots Riley and unionists and others, as well as a look at the Occupy movement in Iowa. In addition, we shall cover the latest development involving United States remote control aircraft. Yet another drone has crashed earlier today in the island nation of Seychelles. There was the crash of an MQ-9 observation plane that was operating just off the coast of Somalia. We'll be speaking live with military reporter Reese Ehrlich about the implications of that event, as well as the recent loss of a drone in Iran. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. In today's program, we will be looking more closely at the overnight events in regard to the various port occupations that took place across the nation. But we have a developing story today. There is yet another United States remote-controlled drone that has crashed. Following the crash over the past fortnight in Iran of a Predator drone, there was today the crash of a similar model, a so-called Reaper drone, model number MQ-9. The Predator is an MQ-1, and the drone that was lost over Iran is called an RQ-170. The latest details that we have about the crash in Seychelles, a series of islands that comprise the nation of Seychelles. And earlier today, the MQ-9 Reaper was apparently taking off at the airport in that East African coastal nation just off the shores of Somalia. And apparently it failed to achieve sufficient takeoff velocity and required itself to land, but the velocity was too high, so it crashed and burned. The fire was put out jointly by Seychelles and United States military and intelligence officials, and the airport was temporarily closed, although it is said since to have reopened. According to one Seychellian official, due to the plane's accelerated landing speed, the aircraft was unable to stop before the runway's end. A statement came from the United States Embassy in Mauritius claiming that the aircraft was unarmed. The United States has been using drone and surveillance aircraft not only in and over Somalia, but also in the coastal waters where there is an epidemic of what some people call piracy and what some Somalians call a defense of their maritime rights. And this, of course, follows the recent crash of the other drone in Iran, the RQ-170, the most advanced of the stealth technology drones of which we are at this point in time aware. And just overnight, the government of Iran said that they will not be returning that drone to the United States, saying that never has any country being spied upon returned the equipment and the intelligence to the offending nation. The United States claims that it was operating over Afghanistan, but it was indeed recovered inside Iranian territory. To help us understand and decode these events, we are joined by Reese Ehrlich, an investigative reporter with a military specialty who has long covered United States clandestine wars in all parts of the world. He is an author of a book called The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Middle East Crisis. Also, Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. Reese Ehrlich, welcome to 5 o'clock shadow. And just off the top, what do you make about this most recent drone crash?
Well, I think it's one of several that have come to light. The impression that both the Bush and the Obama administrations wanted to leave with is that these drones are super safe. American lives are never risked. When they are armed, they only kill terrorists. The reality is quite different. Technology obviously has its failures, as we've seen over the last couple of days, and the armed drones frequently kill civilians by mistake.
The operation, let's stay with the African coast before we go to Iran, where you have quite a deal of expertise. The use of these drones is now being reported as being aggressive activity by the armed ones that are in operation in Somalia, with the simultaneous invasions of Kenya and Uganda without prior normalization with the African Union or the other international forces there. Do you think that there is an escalation from Djibouti, from Seychelles, and other nearby ports of drone operations on the situation in Somalia?
Yes. The U.S. has long been involved in a behind-the-scenes capacity, trying to let the troops from various African countries deal with Somalia. It is a very complicated situation because the Al-Shabaab is an ultra-conservative group that uses Islam as an excuse to impose its own power and its own reactionary policies on the country. But the U.S. and European-backed government in Mogadishu is no prize either. You've got two sets of corrupt warring factions. But the U.S. has sided with one, and it's using the drone technology both for spying and for attacks. And they can be quite deadly, these drone attacks. And as I said, they have the advantage of, since no U.S. troops are endangered, somehow we're not at war.
There are two issues that are often raised in regard to Somalia. One is the issue of piracy. There are contending claims about what is really going on with that. And the more recent one involves the discovery of offshore oil, part of which is off the territorial waters of Somalia, the so-called oil lot L5 in the Indian Ocean. How would you add to the equation these two issues of piracy and petroleum?
Well, when it comes to petroleum, of course, that's the number one U.S. national security issue and key for Western European powers as well. And so getting access to drilling and extracting oil offshore is one of the number one priorities for the U.S. and U.S. oil companies around the world. So that simply means that they're going to be putting renewed efforts on having a pro-U.S. regime in Somalia. The issue of piracy is a bit more complicated because, I mean, it is piracy. These folks are not stealing the money and redistributing it equally amongst the people of Somalia. They're stealing it and keeping it for themselves and paying their own people. So there's sometimes there's a tendency to turn these folks into heroes. They are functioning in a capitalist economy that has gone completely to seed, where there is no central government, there is no central police or army force that's of any significance. And so it's not surprising that people turn to those kind of activities. And then, of course, the Western media and the Western companies who are the victims of this stuff portray them in a particular way, and it's perfectly okay for the U.S. to send its troops or other drones, et cetera, and opposing this. So, as I said, it's a bit complicated, but there is, I don't believe everything you read in the papers.
Our guest is the investigative reporter Rhys Ehrlich, the author of The Iran Agenda, as well as Conversations with Terrorists. And on the issue of the Iranian side of remote control espionage from the other side of the world through these various models of the drones and the recent crash of an RQ-170 inside Iranian territory, you have recently said that this incident reveals that the United States and not Iran is the aggressor. The U.S. has used the excuse of a supposed nuclear weapons program to engage in spying, arming of ethnic guerrillas, and targeted assassinations against Iranian scientists. Yet even the CIA and other intelligence agencies admit that Iran has no nuclear weapons program and is years away from developing an atomic bomb. Within that context, tell us what significance there is about the drone that crashed, and if there is a small failure rate for these drones, does that not imply that there are many more engaging in espionage in Iran?
Oh, I'm sure there's many more. Of course, they're not going to tell us how many, but I'm sure there are. And we don't know what the failure rate is. There's a few high-level examples. We never hear about the ones that might crash in the mountains somewhere and can get covered up. what's significant about the one in Iran is that the Iranians claim that they've hacked into the guidance system and were able to land it smoothly. It's impossible to verify whether that's the case or not. Of course, the United States says, oh, there were technical problems that led it to crash. There was nothing that the Iranians did. But if you'll notice, every time a U.S. helicopter goes down in Afghanistan, for example, it's always due to mechanical difficulties, as in the rotor stopped working after somebody fired a machine gun at it, and then suddenly it's a mechanical malfunction. So I take with a grain of salt everything that comes out of the Pentagon and the CIA about these matters. What's significant is that a government that's very much opposed to U.S. policy now has possession of one of the top secret drones, and whether they claim they can reverse engineer it and figure out what makes it tick. If the Iranians can't, then if they show it to the Chinese or the Russians, they undoubtedly can. And so it's a pretty big setback for the U.S., which tries to pretend that these drones programs are perfect because no Americans get killed with them.
Well, the Obama administration, with the rapidly expanding use of these machines, has tempted one to suppose that we are now in the age that was chronicled in the Terminator movies, the age of Skynet, the age of robots and remote control drones. And
does that mean Arnold Schwarzenegger is going to be the next president?
Well, your final assessment, Reese Ehrlich, about the morality or even the practicality of Xbox remote control spies and assassins from the other side of the world.
Well, when World War I broke out, the tank was the new incredible weapon that couldn't be defeated, and for a period of time it did wreak havoc, and the airplane did the same. And pretty soon other people developed counter technology, and we have bazookas and anti-aircraft guns, et cetera, et cetera. And I think all this spy satellite and spy drone stuff is going through the same process, which is the U.S. has the technological lead, but other forces are going to figure, they're going to develop their own drones, they're going to have anti-drone drones and anti-missile missiles, et cetera, et cetera. So it's going to, I think we're going to look, what we have to look forward to is other countries engaging in the same kind of activity the U.S. has been.
Well, thank you so much, Reese Ehrlich, for the insight. Your books, The Iran Agenda and Conversations with Terrorists, are available. What else may one do to keep up with your great work?
Well, you can go to reeseehrlich.com, and I post my articles there. You can friend me on Facebook if you dare. The Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting has pulled together all my stories about Syria, Egypt, and Gaza from recent trips. And you can just Google my name and that. The Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting is a nonprofit that helps fund journalist trips to cover foreign affairs.
Well, it's been an honor, sir. Keep up the good work, and you'll be back.
Thank you so much.
You'll be back.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And just to recap the day's developments in remote control warfare, there was the crash earlier today in Seychelles of an Air Force MQ-9 Reaper drone. And that follows the recent crash of the RQ-170 drone with the stealth technology in Iran. The government there says it will not be returned to the United States. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. Coming up, a recap of the Occupy Port movement.
He thinks he is a man. Have you killed with your hands? Whose hands are these? The pilot of the drone. Have you killed where are you? I'm sure you
Lacking in confidence, Predator Pilot. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacific Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And since our last broadcast, many events occurred overnight because of the three-hour time zone difference between the West Coast of the United States and our New York point of broadcast origin. And at this point in time, we now catch up on some of those developments, including the new tactic of police in Texas, where there was also an attempt to cause port closures or disruptions. The police, in preventing reporters and bloggers and streamers from documenting the high probability of police misbehavior, are now conducting their dirty business under tents. It's a new tactic, in addition to the various military policies and directives that are filtering down from the U.S. wars abroad to local police forces. And that, in fact, is related to a different tent tactic that occurred overnight in Portland, Oregon, at the port there. And courtesy of our sibling station, KPFA, Pacifica Radio station based in Berkeley, California, and the program Flashpoints, we hear this live report from the event since our last broadcast in Portland from Pacifica affiliate KBOO in Portland, and their reporter, Jenka Soderberg, speaking about the developments that occurred later in the day at the successful occupation of Portland ports.
There were some tents out at Occupy the Portland ports, but a different kind. Occupy Portland protesters brought some tents and actually set them up along the entrance to terminals 5 and 6 at the Port of Portland as part of the blockade of the ports there. So a different kind of tents than the ones that sounds like were being used in Houston. And those port terminals remained shut down until now, and the Port of Portland issued a statement that they would keep them shut through the evening for the interest of safety. So early this morning at 6 a.m., hundreds of protesters, over 1,000, went to Terminals 5 and 6 in Portland, which are the terminals that are owned by Goldman Sachs. And so that was those particular terminals were targeted. The terminals were shut down with hundreds of people in each location shuttling back and forth, and there were port officials then decided to officially shut down and put fences across the street so that trucks could not enter those two ports. People had a sit-in protest, set up blockades, and in fact several dozen people laid down on railroad tracks this morning. There was a second shift scheduled to come in at 4 p.m., and so there was a second shift of protesters that arrived, a second wave around 4, and at that time the Port of Portland issued a statement that they would shut the gates, maintain the closure officially through the evening. Of course, their focus was on the lost wages of workers today, although many of the protesters were workers who actually said that this action will actually have a broader impact of a larger run of things than just a single day's lost wages, because it's bringing attention to the conditions, particularly of the truck drivers that work in the port without union representation. People are still there. There was a second wave that came in. There's now again over 1,000 people at the two ports, the two terminals, Terminal 5 and 6 in Portland. And the reason for those particular ports is the ownership of Goldman Sachs and the conditions of the truck drivers, who are forced to work very long hours at poverty wages with no restrooms and safety violations by the company involved in owning that port. Now, in the terminals right now, there is not a visible police presence. The port authority has set up its own barricade and has security, but the riot police appear to have disbanded from the site. There's also a roving bike squad that's going between the terminals to support the protests at each one, and they were stopped a couple of times by motorcycle police, but are now able to freely move again between the two terminals that are shut down. The mic checks today were focusing on what's happening in other places, in Oakland, in Los Angeles, and in Japan, where there is a solidarity strike by the Rail Workers Union. People in Portland are preparing for more actions, and the Occupy movement is as strong as it ever has been here in Portland.
And that, the reporting of KBOO, the Pacifica affiliate in Portland, Oregon, the correspondent Jenka Soderberg, speaking with our colleague Dennis Bernstein of the program Flashpoints Overnight with the latest developments at the Portland port occupation. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. And moving on to the events in Oakland, California, we have this just in from Judith Scher of the Interpress News Service about the controversy between the Occupy activists and the cold feet of at least some of the management of unions on the West Coast, in particular the International Longshore Workers Union. At the rank-and-file level, there was tremendous support for the occupation actions, but there was a diffident tone from the official leadership. And Judith Scher reports as follows. The decision to shut down the port was controversial inside and outside the Occupy movement, even though targeting Goldman Sachs and its role at the port was not in dispute. According to Michael Siegel, an attorney for the Oakland Occupy movement, Goldman executives can take credit for many of the financial crises of the past decade, including insider trading fraud, credit default swaps, and subprime mortgages. But most unions still sat out the blockade, neither condemning it or supporting it officially. The Oakland Education Association did strongly endorse the action. Private maritime businesses in the Port of Oakland, quote, use rent-free public land that generates $27 billion annually in trade. That, according to Betty Olson Jones of the Teachers Union, she suggested that taxing them 1% would be enough to pay off Oakland school debt, to restore full library services, and to rehire laid off library workers. Some longshore workers were prominent individually in organizing the shutdown in Oakland, but union leadership opposed it, and that over a labor dispute between the Longshore Workers Union and the Export Grain Terminal in Longview in the state of Washington. The Occupy movement and the ILWU say that the company broke a promise to hire longshore workers, and both want that pledge fulfilled. But according to one of the leaders of the ILWU, President Robert McElrath, he said that he wanted the Occupy movement to stay out of their labor conflict. And he said, quote, the ILWU's fight for democracy is the hard-won right to chart our own course to victory, warning that the union does not want outsiders to adopt the struggle as their own, given the danger that they might do so, quote, according to Robert McElrath, the head of the ILWU, in order to advance a broader agenda destructive to our democratic process and one that jeopardizes our two-year struggle in Longview. Some of the issues in the Oakland occupation that took place and continued overnight. This now from the Without Walls Film Project, melange sampling of some of the events in Oakland overnight, including the voices of Boots Riley, one of the leading community organizers for the events in that part of the state, as well as the educator Angela Davis.
Not capitalists. We are for education and housing, not prisons and police. We want love. We want community. We want creativity, and we want freedom.
If you have a dollar, stick it in somebody's envelope. The envelopes look like this. They got the pink on the front, or somebody's got a sign like this. Thank you very much for supporting the truckers.
Gates was being held down this morning by truckers who saw the flyer and decided to join us.
I think it's absolutely important that the Occupy movement is standing with the ILWU, which is the most radical sector of the organized labor movement. But I'm here also because I think we need a movement that is anti-racist, a movement that is feminist, a movement that is opposed to environmental violence, and one that stands up for food rights. And today this is an extremely important issue.
Today to close down the ports for one day to make a statement about greed, to make a statement about the fact that we can't keep abusing our workers. We have to at some point turn the page.
And and that's standing for communication workers, which is my union, but we're standing in solidarity with the longshoremen. And the longshoremen have had issues with being pushed out of the port, which was their always their union right to be here. And Goldman Sachs and EGT have taken over the port and have brought in workers that they're paying like a third of the wages. And so the truckers are not Teamsters. A lot of them aren't Teamsters anymore. A lot of the dock workers are not longshoremen anymore. And this all happened because of these two corporations in this port.
It's effective because nothing ever happened in this country or any country when you had 1% controlling all the wealth. Nothing ever happened unless there was all-out revolt and all-out disruption of the commerce. So people who say marching doesn't do any good, they need to really read their history. Susan B. Anthony, the women's right, the black rights, Rosa Parks, nothing ever happened until people got angry and got out and started fighting back. And that's what I see what's happening. We're defending ourselves.
I know, I saw you.
The issues as we see them, and the reason we're at the port, is should we have fair trade or free trade? We think it ought to be fair trade. Where we used to have national corporations in this country that took pride in American products and the American people have now gone multinational. They now have all our products made overseas and shipped back, and we have nobody left to do the work here. All the products are shipped are made overseas and come back. Point being, you go to the store, you go to Penny, Sears, Macy's, see what you can find made in this country. You can't find anything made in this country anymore. The other issue down here is a misclassification of workers. The port drivers here are what you call owner-operators. Some own their trucks, some don't. They're controlled by the major shippers, the Wall Street people, and those people get paid by the load. However, because they're misclassified, they don't have workers' compensation, they don't have Social Security paid, they don't have benefits, and they make very little in wages.
When you talk about truckers getting hurt, you know, it's something that you could say because they're getting money taken out of their pocket today, but the organization that occurs through this kind of event is priceless. And if anything happens to these people in the future, if their jobs are threatened, if the whole economy takes a big dive, the network that we've set up today is going to be the same network that's used for years to come to organize workers and youth together and to show solidarity in between the different groups.
You notice you saw all these full-page ads about how the workers were opposed to it. The workers are not opposed to it. But the full-page ads, who paid for those? The Port of Oakland and the major corporations. That's why, because when you shut these ports down and the ships don't move and the containers sit, it costs them a fortune. It's a way to get the message out. Now, is there a sacrifice? Yeah, there's a sacrifice by the union workers and there's a sacrifice by the owner-operators. But every movement has sacrifices. And the issue is, are we right or are we wrong? We're right in this movement. That's why we support it.
The purpose of the port shutdown is to show capitalist America and all the imperialism that exists worldwide that you can no longer conduct business as usual. So we all know that capitalism and greed is what fuels the 1%. So if you hurt them where their pockets and where all their everything exists, then you make them see us as being a very positive and very powerful movement. And EGT, the grain company, Monsanto, they all have to be held accountable.
Mic check!
We decided
at the General Assembly
that we would continue the blockade
if there was police action
other occupations
on the West Coast.
That has,
as far as what I've heard, I heard that Seattle ran into some police repression, possibly involving tear gas, which basically, you know, creates a necessity for us to discuss tonight whether or not we extend the blockades, because we said in no uncertain terms, if there is police repression in any of the port shutdowns, we will extend the blockades as a reaction to that. And so right now we're here, you know, to discuss that based on reports that we have that there have been police repression in different port shutdowns. So we're here to figure out whether we're going to put our money where our mouth is and extend this blockade.
Without walls, the sound overnight of protest in Oakland, including Angela Davis, Boots Riley, and many trade unionists. And we have this just in from our own sources that even after that, there was a blockade of the American President lines in Oakland. And apparently the hundreds of people who took part in that were successful in that blockade, causing a shift shutdown. That from Oakland, California. This is 5 o'clock shadow, and the ports and the coastal areas are not the only targets of contention. There is a reactionary Republican roundup that is focusing much of its attention on the state of Iowa and the upcoming caucuses as part of the primary process, but the Republicans are not the only ones busy in the state of Iowa. In fact, there is also an Occupy movement, perhaps even leading to occupying the caucuses. And the Occupy movement in the heartland is something that was the subject of a conference by participants recently, and Pacifica correspondent Ursula Rutenberg obtained some of the thoughts, which way the wind blows in Middle America, from the Occupy Iowa movement based in Ames, Iowa.
Mic check!
Mic check!
I'm here! For all the towns like Newton, Iowa.
For all the towns like Newton, Iowa.
Who started out with a big corporation like Maytag. Whose CEO drove the company into the ground and used its workers. Who now don't have jobs and had to leave their homes. While the CEOs floated away on their golden parachutes. We need jobs. That's why I'm here.
To me, at the beginning, Occupy was this vague idea that a bunch of people in New York City are causing a ruckus, and I liked it, you know? But why couldn't we do it here in Ames?
That little noise in New York carried out across the rest of the country and across the rest of the world. And it came to Des Moines in October 9th, and it came to ISU a week later, and it's spread around the state now. There are 10, more than that, 12 maybe. 12 Occupy groups here in Iowa alone.
In a matter of hour, it really just peaked. And a week later, when we decided we were all going to meet in the Campanile, and there was about 200 people there, just everyone with their signs. They knew exactly what they wanted to say. They knew exactly why they were there.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I would like. Lower tuition. More state funding. For Iowa State. An easier time here overall.
Yeah.
Mic check.
I'm also here. Because I feel like I'm forced. To go into debt. To get educated. Which is a fundamental human right. Thank you.
Me the most is you see these students get enthused not only about this platform, but they're starting to realize that as students, the policies that are made are made by people who are not necessarily affected by those policies. Those policies are affecting those that are in this movement, and especially students, especially the younger generations. And so this is an opportunity for students to come out and voice their concerns, as I mentioned earlier. And that's why, to me, the student movement within the Occupy movement is perhaps where the future lies within this you know, moving into the future. So,
mic check.
Mic check.
My name is Dan.
My name is Dan.
I spent Sunday and Monday in Des Moines. Be part of a solidarity movement with New York. I am proud. To be of the 99%. I can take our control back of this country. We need to keep going.
Well, you're occupying, huh? You're spending time and effort to occupy. Why the hell don't you spend time and effort to give Christy Vilsack money and door-knocking time? Huh? Can you answer that?
We can't trust either political party to actually follow through and do the things that need to be done. The Democrats had a wonderful opportunity to break up these large financial institutions that literally are the biggest national security threat right now to our country. It's not Iran, it's not any other country. It is these large financial institutions in our own country. Instead of going out and supporting political campaigns, we are demanding that it's time for them to listen to us. Until we make the changes that we need to make, we need to keep the pitchforks at their back and keep them moving. Because if we give them a break, they're going to turn around and walk away from all of this.
I think that the whole concept of democracy is great, but it's obviously it's failed. It's failed us.
Right now, what the larger Occupy movement is doing is changing the conversation. And the one thing that they don't get in all of this, especially the pundits and the politicians, is that there is a focus and there is a demand. The demand is a middle-class guy like me out marching in the streets demanding economic justice. That is the demand. That is the focus. And they are just not bright enough to get it.
We are just taking it one step at a time. I really do envision someday us all being able to live in just communal society. I don't think it'll happen in my lifetime, but
it's going to be a series of small victories, like the small victory that we're having in changing the conversation right now.
For me, it's how could we take one step and how is that going to change? I would really like to see the legal structure of corporations changed. If corporations really are people, they also need to be paying for the costs, because everyone is. It's urgent that that is addressed.
I think having that platform is just, it's so important. We all have thought about this for so long. I don't remember a time where I felt empowered to be able to speak my mind. And just having that opportunity right now is a victory in itself. The power of this Occupy movement is we're spreading that word. Brooklyn Bridge was shut down. And I heard it on there when I was driving back from Montana. I was like, that's the best thing I've heard, you know? They shut down the Brooklyn Bridge. What is this? And that's how it all starts. And now people will start to understand. And first they'll criticize, and then they'll say, wait a minute. That's what I think too. And that's what the beauty of the Occupy movement is. It is a victory in spread of knowledge.
Mic check!
Mic check!
I want you to be loud!
I want you to be loud!
I'm a finance major!
I'm a finance major!
I am a college sophomore!
I'm a college sophomore!
I believe in this endeavor!
I believe in this endeavor!
I believe that it can be solved with logical solutions!
I believe that it can be solved with logical solutions!
It will always be remembered!
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 That we stood up!
That we stood up!
And this nation!
And this nation!
Will say!
Will say!
That this was our finest hour!
That this was our finest hour!
Mic off!
The sounds of the occupied Middle America from Ames, Iowa, produced by Pacifica correspondent Ursula Rudenberg. Thanks also today to Jenka Soderberg of Pacifica affiliate KBOO and Dennis Bernstein, the host of Flashpoints at station KPFA, the Without Walls film project, and Lacking in Confidence for the song Drone Pilot, and to Michael G. Haskins for engineering and Thiago Barroso for production. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. We welcome your comments, tips, leaks, questions, and suggestions with an email to theshadow, theshadow, theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.